Welcome back to another episode of the Meat Mafia podcast. On today's episode, we are joined by Alexander Cortez. Alexander is an online health coach with decades of knowledge on performance in the gym. In our conversation with Alexander, we talked about traveling as a tool for growth, finding archetypes and role models, maintaining high standards for yourself and others, and challenging yourself in the gym and through combat sports. Alexander spent the year of 2020 practicing Muay Thai in Thailand, and he came back to the United States with a new perspective on what it means to build a healthy body. His background provides a unique lens into the world of health and wellness, but he also frequently writes about life more generally, specifically about masculinity, building confidence, and living a fulfilling life. Alexander is an incredibly philosophical guy, and we touched on a lot of different topics here, so sit back and enjoy. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Equip Foods. Equip provides a complete source of grass-fed beef protein with no added chemicals, fillers, binding agents, or artificial coloring or sweeteners. If you're familiar with the supplement industry, you know that most supplements are loaded with ingredients that you can't even pronounce. Equip's unflavored prime has one single ingredient derived directly from grass-fed beef protein. For purists like ourselves who try to only consume balanced, real sources of nutrition, this protein powder checks all the boxes. Go check them out in the link below and use our promo code in the description to get a discount. We get questions all the time about how to incorporate beef liver into a healthy, balanced diet. The questions are usually around how to source high-quality beef liver, how to overcome the taste of liver, and how to travel and still be able to include beef liver into your diet. That's why we love Optimal Carnivore, which provides beef liver supplements as well as an organ complex for people to incorporate beef liver without the taste and with the convenience of just being able to pack it into a bag and toss it into your mouth when you're ready for your supplements. Beef liver is an important part of my diet because it provides me with the B12, copper, vitamin A that you can't really get from any other food groups. Beef liver is truly nature's vitamin, and being able to incorporate it in such an easy form, such as this supplement, makes it that much better. Go check out Optimal Carnivore and let us know what you think. Alexander, welcome to the Meat Mafia podcast. Pleasure to have you here. We're excited for this conversation. We know you're going to bring a lot to the table, so excited to dive in here.
Looking forward to it.
What, my first question is, how do we get a doctorate in bro science like you have?
All right, so there's a little bit of a story to this. the doctorate in bro science from Chattistan. So, you know, for anyone that's on Twitter a lot, you become very familiar with certain Twitter tropes.
Mm.
And one of, like, there's a recurrent theme on Twitter that for people who are blue checks and they have a PhD of some kind, and they'll want to remind their following an audience of that, that I am a doctor of education and you need to respect me, essentially. Like, I have a superior opinion. So the doctor of bro science was just my play on that. If I was being honest, do I think I deserve a doctorate after 12 years of training clients? I think so. Like, there's a level of applied knowledge I have that I think is pretty incomparable. But yeah, also it's a pun, essentially. It's a meme. Yeah, and then also too, in the fitness industry, there's this deference given to science and evidence based training, or what people think is science and evidence. Yeah, if you really dig into science as a field, or so the whole field of science, whether it be fitness, whether it be nutrition, whether it be sports science, exercise science, you know, hell, biology, social sciences, the replication crisis spans the entire paradigm.
Yeah.
Bad studies, bad research, falsified research, compromised research, private interest groups, special interests, lobbyists, science trademark is, you know, kind of compromised. So then, you know, taking science as this arbiter of truth in thinking that you need to listen to people who supposedly are scientists, PhD. No, you fucking don't.
Yeah.
A lot of people in a lot of fields are completely full of shit. Very recently there was that news headline, which I kind of dug into because I was really fascinated by it, that apparently basically that last decade of Alzheimer's research and the supposed top protein breakdown, causes Alzheimer's, this whole area of research was based upon falsified data.
Wow.
By two scientists. I forget the names. But, you know, I mean, yeah, so like on a broad level, okay, so we had a whole decade where billions of dollars was spent, tons of speculation, conjecture was made, you know, probably tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of recommendations were given out. whether it be to patients or whether it be to research departments of like, this is what we need to study, this we need to focus on. At the end of a decade, we find out, oh, this was all based on bullshit that two people made up for money.
Yeah. It's funny because you come onto the world of Twitter too, and there's a little bit of like this playful banter around people who are always in need of like the study to support every single piece of data or new ideas around performance, nutrition, health, even beyond that. And all these fields are generally soft sciences. So it's like, when you look into the past and see what's worked in the past, generally, you know, that's kind of the best roadmap for building out any sort of plan around health and nutrition. And then, you know, there's a lot of these like new studies being done on things that kind of like force people to, you know, think that they know potentially more than other people. It's an interesting sphere to be in.
Yeah, I mean, nutrition is like a lot of other fields. I mean, I'm not the first person to bring up like, you know, the low fat craze or, you know, low fat craze, low carb craze, you know, the various, we had a few decades now, kind of like anti red meat, anti eggs, anti saturated fat. Is red meat bad for you? You know, now I can tell, obviously, the social shift now is going to be demonizing animal protein, you know, versus bug protein, essentially. You know, but like, you see this stuff happening. It's like, what are the studies? Studies don't mean anything in isolation. You know, like good, if you're going to be an honest scientist and practice good science, you are going to make observations. Like, this is sort of like the classic sort of like Aristotle model of science. Like, you make observations of just what you see, and you can derive a lot of truth just from observation. You can establish cause and effect. Then you create theories where it's like, okay, like I'm seeing things happen. I'm seeing A equals B. I'm seeing the same patterns happen over and over. Let me try and figure out what the mechanism might be. And then you test those things. You find a way to test it. And then if you can test it enough times repeatedly over and over and over again, you keep getting the same outcomes, maybe you're getting closer to truth. It doesn't mean you found what is exactly true, but you've gotten closer to recognizing some, you know, first principle kind of relationship. That's good science. A single study that's done, that's paid for by Big Corn, you know, that then gets submitted to NBC for publication, like that is peak, I don't know what you call it, this is peak nepotism. Yes. You know, then to default to that, I was like, well, it's science. I'm like, that's not science. That's people paying for their personal agenda. You know, like God, like there's a whole book written of how to lie with statistics. You know, to be able to lie with numbers is of in itself a skill.
Yeah.
Yeah. And most people are numerically illiterate. You know, you can very easily, this is done all the time in exercise science. You'll look at, there'll be a study. It's like, oh, this was I'll sort of just, you know, get something basic. Like a study was done and it showed that this exercise leads to 25% more muscle growth. Like, oh shit, wow, that's a lot. Damn. And then you look at, you go in and like, you look at the study and, you know, the p-values they used and the way they plot out the data and the actual muscle growth and, you know, the relative difference versus the absolute difference was this exercise built, you know, basically 2 grams more muscle than the other exercise. There's actually almost no, there was no meaningful statistical difference in outcome, but we measured it so many different ways that we finally got the result we want. And now it's 25%. And that gets done all the time. And then those studies never get replicated again.
Yes.
You know, yeah. Like that's a common problem issue. Like, again, replication crisis, where half of all research that's done is basically unreplicable or just crap research. It's just, you know, bad experiments get set up. You know, but a bad experiment with a, I guess you could almost say like a mimetic kind of outcome that people like and it sounds good. Like it can spread. You know, psychology is notorious for this. Of like supposedly psychological truths, realities of, you know, human behavior. Then the data gets dug into. It's like, oh, it's never got replicated. Never been replicated since. But now we believe this about that. Well, this is how people behave.
Yes. And you touched on the animal protein versus bug protein. And Harrison and I touch on this all the time. You particularly see that in the demonization of red meat of these organizations and scientists. They're very strategic. They know exactly how to manipulate the percentages in a way that makes you go, holy shit, this actually isn't good for me to be eating. And that's why I think you make a great point too, of like, regardless of what side you're on, don't just accept a statistic as face value, like take it another step further and do your own research to figure out what that percentage actually means.
Yeah, 100%. And then, like, this is where you have to, like, I give a lot more weight to anecdotal historical data than, I guess you'd say, like, experimental, like, study data. If human beings, if nature has been doing this, the same recurrent pattern of behavior for essentially millennia, it's meat, for example. That's a very easy one. Like, okay, like, how long are people eating meat? We can reasonably estimate, like, a couple hundred thousand years, like, at least. Like, there's no stop point of how far back that historical record goes. Okay. So this thing that we ate since, let's just say, 500,000 BC, it suddenly became really bad for us, like, in 1975 AD. That doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense. Like, there's a big break in logic there. Like, it's it's like when I was in India, for example. I've been to India, like, I've lived there for a period of time, like, I've traveled there. This is more observational. Like, this is scientific. Well, it's observational. You go to a country where a lot of people are vegetarian, you see, okay, people are vegetarian, a lot of diabetes, insulin resistance, a lot of malnutrition, a lot of diseases of famine, essentially, from lack of certain nutrients. People don't eat meat here. You go to another country, like Hong Kong, I think, is the example for this. Hong Kong is, like, the highest red meat consumption of any country on earth. Its average lifespan is like 86 years. India is like 68. Now, this is corollary, right? But I can go to one country, they eat a lot of red meat, less obesity. I go to another country, they eat very far less meat, very low protein diet, a lot more obesity, a lot of impoverished diseases, lower lifespan. If I weigh those two things together, it's like, what do you think is a superior diet for human health? I'm like, I don't think it's the low protein diet. I think it's a higher protein diet. That's not a, that's a, I mean, you could call that a biased observation. I'm like, I don't think that's an uninformed observation. If you have people in this country, they're dead at 68, insulin resistant. This country, they're dead at 86, no insulin resistance. Did the diet play a role in their health? Like, obviously it does. Like, this, again, this is basic observation. Like, to argue otherwise, and, like, you're just kind of being senseless at that point.
It seems like there's a lot of camps out there too now who are trying to just like convince people of all these like new ideas around nutrition, which is a bit frightening. But one of the things I was interested in talking to you about, I heard a bunch about your COVID story and how you kind of made 2020 one of the best years of your life through travel and things like that. I think that'd be a great starting point, just learning more about you and sort of how you think about the things and how you think about things and how you view the world. We know you're big into health and nutrition, but sounded like you had a pretty cool 2020.
2020 was great. I guess let me give you some context to this. I've been a personal trainer since 2010. And I've always been very observational of the world at large. And I saw around, like, probably around 2012, 2013, that the fitness industry was exploding due to Instagram, due to this, the online world. And this digital economy was arising. And today, like, we call this having a personal brand, influencer, Wi-Fi money. Nobody called it that in 2012. The idea of making money online in 2012 was. It was completely novel. Like, nobody knew what they even meant. It was this like 4-hour workweek kind of idea of, like, what? Like, how does anyone get paid online? Like, who's going to pay for your shit, right? But I saw how this online economy was growing, and people, at least in the fitness industry, they were making money from having a following, from having information products. YouTube was steadily growing, and there was this knowledge economy that was, getting bigger by the day. I'm like, okay, like, there's a way to capitalize on this. Fitness. The classical job being a personal trainer, that's an hourly job. But if you use the tools that you have online, you can scale your knowledge. So I knew at some point in the future, I'm like, I need to get to a level of having enough knowledge, applied knowledge, practical knowledge, book knowledge, build my skill sets in regards to sales, marketing, knowing how to navigate sort of the online culture where I can start an online business. I can create a following around myself. And I finally went all in on that in 2017. And it worked. I started posting on Twitter a lot, started getting a following, started getting my email list growing substantially. And in 2018, I kind of had that breakthrough moment where things took off. you know, started making money where it went from being a couple hundred dollars a month, like, oh, cool. Now I'm making, you know, $5,000, $6,000, $7,000, $8,000, $10,000 a month. Like, oh shit, like this is working. Awesome. At the same time this is happening, Trump is president. The US is becoming hyper-polarized. And I didn't know COVID was going to happen, but it was very obvious that like we're reaching ever greater levels of fractionation. Like every day there's a new fractured point in culture, there's new cultural divisions. Like the, you know, again, this is cliche to say, the country is coming apart socially.
Mm-hmm.
And like we've seen this now, like with the, you know, I could reference like the Dobbs decision, you know, the Roe versus Wade getting reversed, of like now states having more power.
Yes.
You know, decentralization, this concept of decentralization is really taking hold across all these different social spheres. So this is happening. I'm like, I grew up in California. I'm not going to go on my California rant, but like I was fed up with California. I'm like, you know, I don't want to live in California anymore. This is now 2019. Like, I want to actually live abroad. So I decided I'm going to travel abroad for a year, maybe longer, and see how it goes. As it happened, this is now late 2019, COVID is in the background in China. And then when COVID finally took effect globally, I was with my girlfriend, now wife, in Egypt. Lockdowns start happening. This was in March. And we're trying to figure out, like, do we go back to the United States? Do we, like, where do we go? Airports were closing. Everything, the situation was changing by the minute. And we were able to get into Thailand. So I ended up being in Thailand basically the entire year 2020 from March until December, which was amazing. It was awesome. So it gave me time to focus my business far more on like the home training, home gym market. I expanded my product line significantly. I launched a membership group. Like business basically doubled in 2020 because everybody was at home. Nobody was working and people will still spend money.
Yes.
So everybody was spending money on everything online. It was fucking amazing. I'll never have another year like that again. It was this perfect storm of everything that could go right for an online business. And at the same time, I started training Muay Thai, working with a very famous champion in the Golden Age of Muay Thai named Sagat. So I was working with him for 6 months, got into training Muay Thai regularly. That became my thing. So 2020, it was a great year for personal growth. I got into fantastic shape, learned how to fight. Business took off, made the most amount of money I ever made. It was an awesome year.
Yeah.
And then it was funny when I finally came back to the United States, since I was at a point, I'm like, okay, I need to change my tax situation, establish tax base in a different state, you know, completely separate myself from California. And so I get back to 2021 and everybody's in a bad mood.
Yeah.
Basically. In the whole US, it's like it was the summer of Black Lives Matter, George Floyd, all the peaceful protests with all the cities being burnt down. You know, that's, we could go on that for a while, yes. But so yeah, cities being burnt down, crimes exploding, massive increase in murders, larceny, theft, looting, all this stuff, you know, race wars. I'm like, and I get back from Thailand, I'm like, wow, man, everyone's in a really bad fucking mood here.
Yeah.
So it was interesting. I'm like, clearly we've had different experiences. And then of course on Twitter, you see this constant, you know, daily refrain of like my mental health is declining, you know, depression skyrocketing, supposedly alcoholism, drug use, kids are being left behind. And I feel bad about this, right? And like, I'm laughing, but I'm like, shit, like this was clearly a difficult time for most people.
Yeah.
Personally though, the best fucking time I've ever had.
Yeah.
It was great. And it allowed me to set my life now where I can do whatever the fuck I want in any day,
mm-hmm.
and have total freedom.
Do you?
So, thank you, China.
Thank you, China. Number one. Do you think that after that Thailand experience, do you think it's important for all men to experience like an environmental shift of just getting out of wherever you've been and forcing yourself to go somewhere new and allow the change to be embraced from everything that comes from that?
I would say yes. This is what travel can do for you. I'm not going to say it will, but this is what it can do. I think if you travel with the right mindset, we all grow up in a place. And you know, for most people, unless your parents travel a lot, you constantly change environments, you're probably going to grow up in one or two places for most of your life, most of your childhood at least. So your paradigm of reality, what you think about the world, the people that you know, it's shaped by that place. And you don't know that many people. You grow up in a town, even if you grow up in a large city, you only know where you live. You go somewhere else where it's a different social history, different cultural history. this different history period, if it's a different civilization, if you go from east to west or from west to east, two completely different civilizational cultures. They don't are not really compatible with each other. Yeah, I've said this, you know, comment here before, but like, you know, Indian civilization, you know, Southeast Asian civilizations, it's hard to compare them to Western world because they're really not connected with each other up until very recently. They developed, not in isolation, but they developed as geographically separate for many thousands of years. But so you go somewhere else, you go to a different civilization, and what you know, what you think about the world, it gets tested by your new environment. So it gives you a different perspective on human relationships, on truth, on your, you know, your own personal beliefs, on, you know, the connections that you have with your home, if you have any, with your family, with your culture, with your native language versus the new language. You know, are all cultures equal? That's its own discussion. Maybe they're not. If you travel around enough different places, life is certainly better in some places versus others. Yeah, you know, some cultures have certain advantages, some have disadvantages. Okay. So it gives you perspective on the human condition. Yeah, and then from those experiences, you develop a better sense of who you are and what you believe in, how you live your life. And then, you know, if you decide to settle in a place, whatever plans you make, I would say you're going to make a much more informed, you're going to make a much more informed decision based upon this, you know, a broader set of, you know, lived experiences, perspectives, knowledge. And also it's cool to travel. This for the sheer novelty of it. Like, you can see the world, and the world's a beautiful place. And there's all different kinds of people.
Have there been any travel experiences particularly for you that have kind of shaped your or shifted your perspective in a way that has been more powerful than others?
I would say this, like, this is like a California specific, the United States. So like, for people that grew up in California, Californians are very arrogant, like unknowingly, where like there's this assumption that California is like the most progressive state, the best state, the greatest place on earth. And you go to other countries, you go to other states, and you realize, like, it's not. California is certainly geographically beautiful, the environment, you know, the natural beauty is amazing. Mm-hmm. But California as a state, as a bureaucracy, you know, the government, government services, you know, just, you know, the freeway system, a lot of things in California really don't run well. So what was interesting to me when I was much younger, like this, like my late teens, early 20s, like kind of traveled around the United States a bit, and I saw other states, and I realized, like, oh, California's kind of overrated. Like, this, you know, this state next door is just as nice as California, and the roads, the freeway is better. You go, you know, like, I mean, I could, there's a lot of, like, you don't, this is, again, like I said, very California specific. You grow up in California and you go to the South, anywhere, like any, just pick a Southern state, go to Texas, go to Alabama, Georgia, Mississippi, Missouri, Florida, you know, Tennessee, you're like, oh, people here are really nice and really friendly. And there's, you know, like the assumption that Californians have of like every other state except them is like rednecks with KKK running around hanging black people. You're like, maybe I just believe a lot of stupid shit from in California. And then, you know, so there's that factor. You also see, and I've seen this the last 20 years as California has precipitously fucking declined in a lot of ways, that who you vote for does in fact matter. It will eventually matter. Yeah. The people that run your fucking government, their decision making is going to at some point affect you and your quality of life and your mobility. And, you know, you're going to have to make decisions, you know, based off of their decisions. You know, so that was kind of like, there was no one moment that was eye opening, but it growing up in California my whole life and then traveling, it definitely broke my favoritism of like, this is the greatest place on earth. It's not. It's one state of 50. It certainly has cultural capital. It's a big economy, like no question about that. But life is good in a lot of other places. And you also see, too, as you travel abroad, you go to different cities internationally, U.S. cities kind of just fucking suck. European cities as a whole, just pick a fucking country. Go to any old city in any European country, whether it be France, England, Germany, Spain, whatever. Way fucking nicer, way easier to walk around. Architecture is beautiful. You're like, wow, this is amazing.
Yeah.
Go to, you know, for me, like go to my fucking suburban hometown. And you're like, it just like, you can't compare the two. It's just like, it's like a car paradise, straight suburbia. You go to Los Angeles, you got to be in your car, right? Driving around. Homeless population, crime are ridiculous. I can go to Eastern Europe and go to Slovenia. I can go to Budapest, Bucharest. I go to basically any major city in Eastern Europe And it's nicer and safer and better rent and less crime and more pleasant to walk around. And then you go back again, you go back to US cities, you're like, this is kind of fucking third world. Like American cities are just, you know, large, especially large cities are kind of shitty.
Yeah.
They're not that great. Miami's, you know, Miami compared to Mexico City, fucking overrated. Compared to a lot of cities in South America, fucking overrated. You know, but like for the US, it's kind of cool.
Yeah.
It still has culture there. But like the US as a whole, I would say it this way. The United States is the absolute best country in the world for making money, bar none. We are fucking capitalism on steroids. If you want to get fucking rich, come to the United States. Do business here. Get paid in the USD. It's going to be the currency of the world for a long time. In regards to quality and livability of culture itself, city life, it's subpar.
Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people came away to that through COVID of just realizing, like, I think I'm the perfect example of being in New York for 3 years. Harrison was up in Boston for a few years. You're in these Northeast cities. And when you're in the moment and you're working this corporate job, you think it's great. You know, you get captivated by the energy, what everyone else is doing. And then you're pulled away from that. And you're like, well, why the fuck am I actually here? Why don't I go somewhere else? And I think that there are a ton of people that have had a similar awakening to what you're talking about and are way happier because of it.
Yeah, no, I mean, I have no doubt. Like, the exodus from various blue cities or blue states the last year and a half to red states, or even people moving overseas, like, it's been substantial.
Yeah.
These people realize as they got, especially with the lockdowns, and, you know, if you were, again, depending upon where you live, what state you were in, what city you were in, you might have had a friendly local government, sheriff's department that didn't really enforce anything, was much looser, people were less paranoid. Or you might have been somewhere where the lockdowns were ridiculously long and people were getting arrested on the street. And, you know, for the first time, you have to, again, like, question, like, who are my leaders? Who's making these decisions? Because these are human beings that were deciding this. And then do I want to stay living here? No, I'm going to leave. Okay, where am I going to move to?
Yeah, the idea of remote work, I think, actually helped a lot of people actually spend time in other places too, because I think the American mentality around travel is typically just to, like, show up, do the top 10 list, and then get out of there. But you could actually go and spend like a month in a place and actually get to enjoy the culture and see what the people are actually really like, or, you know, just settle in a place for a longer period of time remotely. And this is obviously, you know, probably not for, this wasn't everyone's experience, but I know several people who did this type of thing. And it actually gives you a lens into how life could be in a different place, which, you know, I think and I hope that a lot more people get to take advantage of that, because it's valuable to be able to move around and get to experience different cultures and perspectives of the world.
Oh, hugely. I mean, the remote work shift, that was really interesting, since it's one of those trends that nobody could have predicted 30 years ago. Like the internet is what made that happen. Yeah, if you had told people that in 1990 you're going to work for, like, if you had told anyone in 1990 that you're going to have the internet and it's going to enable, you know, 30-40% of the workforce to literally work from home and you'll never have to go to an office ever again, like, it would have been an insane idea. Like, nobody would believe that. Yeah, and then now today, like, you have major companies, FANG corporations, where they've shifted to work from home. You know, like, a majority of their employee base works from home. It's like, okay, like, you don't have to go to an office anymore. You're not geographically tied to a particular location, particular city. Yeah, like, so, I mean, it's actually democratized work, I think, because now, I mean, you can work for a company, you could be anywhere in the world, they could be anywhere in the world. Like, what is that going to do for salaries and what people get paid? I don't know, but it's certainly going to change things.
Definitely.
You know, the fact that I can live in America and I can hire someone in India, in Argentina, in the Dominican Republic, in, you know, Georgia, in Eastern Europe, and we can all work, you know, I mean, not in the same time zone, we can all work on the same project and correspond with each other. That like, it almost breaks the mind to think about that. Like, this is never, you've never been capable of this before. We have never been capable of this before in human history.
Mm-hmm.
We can harness human capital from anywhere in any given time. Wow. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. Like, that's insane to think about. You know, again, up until 2010, if you were going to work, you had to go to that place. You had to physically be in that place. There was no other way to do it.
Yeah. The leverage is pretty incredible. One of the things that we were interested in, Ajak, was you'd mentioned some of the societal issues that you returned to and just saw, you know, you were talking about the George Floyd situation, how unhappy a lot of Americans are. And we know that's something you do a lot of speaking about is just the role of masculinity and strength and maybe where that's gone in society. So do you see a strong correlation between like a lack of masculinity and some of the issues that have arisen over the last few years?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, I mean, if I had to, it's hard, always hard to reduce cultural issues down to a single thing. Because it's always, it's multifactorial. You know, but if I had to point to what I think is one thing that sort of underlies, you know, all of America's problems, it's a lack of standards. And lack of standards, I mean, everywhere. Just pick a field and there's a lack of standards. Whether that be in education, and it's because of racial affirmative action, you know, reverse affirmative action, you know, discrimination against Asians, discrimination against whites. Like, okay, let's lower the standards to accommodate, you know, like basically let's lower the standards to accommodate more people who would, you know, normally like would not meet the standards, whether that's in the military, whether that's in corporations in the hiring process, whether that's in like California, used as an example. People can, I call it like the urban Munchausen syndrome, where if you live in a city and that quality of life in that city slowly declines over time, it's very easy to rationalize the decisions that get made on level city governance. Like, oh, well, crime's going up, but you know, it's not that bad. Okay, homeless population went up. Well, you know, people have problems. We shouldn't be too judgmental. You know, things get, you know, things take longer to get fixed. Well, you know, at least they're getting fixed. You know, the cops are slower to respond. Oh, you know, now I'm kind of questioning living here, but yeah, I can afford to have my car broken into. Like, it's not gonna kill me. It's not gonna put me on the street. Okay, you just keep rationalizing every small tyranny that happens until you hit a point in time. You're like, how the fuck is this? Why am I living here? Like, what am I paying for to live here? You can see that in education. You know, U.S. education standards slowly just been declining and declining and declining and declining, and there's always a reason given. Yeah, whether that reason is, you know, based on cultural Marxism or just like this is really a breakdown in logic and truth, like this removal of objectivity. You keep having this continuous lowering of the bar over and over and over again. Now, what does that mean, you know, for being a man? Well, it means being a man doesn't really mean anything. The same way now, like being a woman doesn't mean being anything. Anyone could be a woman. I can wake up tomorrow and put on a wig and I'm a woman if I feel like it, apparently. You know, I got women biceps and fucking women hair, I have a big hairy ball sack. That's a woman ball sack. If I feel like it, you have to accept my truth. You're the bigot.
Yes.
And like, we laugh at this, like that's fucking insanity. Like there's people actually doing that. Like they're browbeating people with that. And they're claiming sort of like oppressed status. Like, how did we get here? I would say like we accepted a lower standard of truth, of performance, skill, of competency. We've made being good at something not mean anything. And now we have lost our entire objections to reality. And when you cannot objectively distinguish between what's true and what's false, when the definition of definition is getting edited, how do you make sense of the world at large? And how, if you're a man individually, how do you know how to act? The way that we create ourselves is from our cultural social role models.
Right.
We need to believe in something that tells you, hey, you know what? You need to be strong and competent. Yeah. What does that mean? Just don't overthink it. Like you need to be strong and you need to be good at shit. You know, super basic, right? If I tell you that strength is oppressive and you being good at something might make people who are bad at something feel bad, what are you supposed to do? And I'm being super reductionist right now. But again, you analyze, like I said, all these different areas of society, and you see this breakdown. You know, it doesn't matter what the realm is. And then you wonder, like, why are people going crazy? Like, how could you not go crazy?
Yeah. Yeah, there's no the dilution of objective truth is something that I think you hit on that is so spot on. I was reading one of your articles about archetypes, and I think that from a personal empowerment standpoint, having an archetype or two, you know, a handful of archetypes that you in your mind create, whether it's through historical perspective, knowing someone in the past and how they were, and then trying to build yourself into those types of characters is a good way about, you know, kind of reversing some of these narratives that have been pushed on us. Is that something that you think about and something that you talk to your clients about just in terms of empowering, figures that have done certain things in the past?
Yes. I mean, what you need to be, what every man needs to do. I mean, this is sort of like, this is the burden of being a man, the burden of male performance is like, it is on you to save yourself. So if you're a young man today, you need to find those role models, you know, those archetypical role models that you can imitate. You know, not to copy them and be them, but be similar enough to them, you know, be akin in characteristic to them, that you can be, you know, actually be a man and be functional in society and be competent, and you can design and have control of your own life. You know, if you don't do that, then you're at the mercy of whatever social forces and whatever, you know, whatever's trendy, and it's probably going to eat you alive.
Yeah. Are there any archetypes that you particularly resonate with, or historical figures that you kind of model your life after?
Yeah, there's probably only one. So I mean, like this, and this is very generic. This isn't anything, you know, special. Yeah, a lot of young men can tell you this. When I was growing up, so I grew up in the 1990s, and this is before cartoons went woke and gay. So the boy cartoons back then were all superhero cartoons. So, it was Batman, Superman, Spider-Man, Justice League, Conan the Barbarian. I remember very distinctly. Yeah, and what is a heroic archetype? A hero is hyper capable. That's what makes someone heroic. You have an elite level of capability that no matter what situation, no matter what kind of challenging situation you encounter, you are able to handle it because of a combination of courage and skill and just in general force of personality, force of will. That's being heroic. And I always identified with that. I want to be the kind of person where I can handle anything that life threw at me. I want to be that kind of man. You know, what do heroes lack? Heroes typically don't show weakness, because if you show weakness, you lose, right? Like, it's very basic. Like, you have to be strong to be a hero, fundamental. Heroes are typically not dependent upon other people. I've seen this change now the last 20 years or so, where, like, if you watch modern films, cartoons, there's a lot more emphasis put on, like, cooperation. And having having a sort of a supportive network of friends, like, to help you accomplish something, versus like 30 years ago, it was much more like the lone wolf kind of hero. Like, it's you, maybe your partner or two, your team, and like that's it.
Right.
It's not everybody else. You know, and this is why the last crop of Star Wars movies were so fucking god awful for many reasons. But like a hero, it's a fundamental understanding that it's you against the world. You're going to live your life alone. You're going to die alone. And it's up to you to make a difference. Mm. You can't rely upon anyone but yourself. And that always resonated with me. Yeah, I still think of like my life that way to this day. Like I'm the master and commander of my reality, of my universe. I'm the one that determines its direction. No one else.
Mm.
You know, like you're never going to see me, you know, complain about I'm stressed, I have anxiety. The fuck is that? Yeah, I can't remember a single fucking Saturday morning cartoon that any fucking superhero ever said he felt anxious about shit. Not a fucking thing. That's not a male emotion. Like I don't believe in it. Anxiety is for women. You know, same for stress. Like, you know, my dad, I don't remember a time in my life ever. My dad's had a pretty eventful life where he ever came home and was like, I'm really stressed and worried. Like, my male health is suffering right now. The fuck? He's never said those words. It would never occur to him to even express that in the first place. He doesn't think about his life, the world, that way.
Yeah.
You know, now, you know, so many decades later, it's like everyone's a fucking godless, sensitive, masculine, like new male, up in their feelings. It's fucking disgusting. So yeah, you know, all of that said, like, what do I model my archetypes on? Just be heroic.
Yeah.
Do you think the annihilation of ego, like there's this whole like school of thought around like reducing the ego. Do you think that's something that people are like playing too much into, where, you know, ego shouldn't be really viewed as this bad thing? Like, there is a certain amount of self-identity and building oneself up that actually helps people, you know, become their own hero.
Yes. So this is the issue with ego as it gets conceptualized in modern 21st century discourse. If you go look at how Freud's kind of the originator of the idea of ego in the first place. Now you could kind of trace ego back to like the ancient Greeks, but let's go with Freud. Freud wrote in German, and how he described personality he didn't, it was not the word ego. Ego was translation. He described the human, he described human psychology, the human mind sort of being in three parts. You have like the present I, which is like who you are in the present moment of life, just in your life. You have the I that is below, which is sort of your underlying, like more base motivations. And you have the I above, which is sort of like a higher self, so to speak, of like, you have what you aspire to, you have what you actually do on a day-to-day basis. And then you have like your darker impulses. So you have this three-part structure. That got translated into ego, where ego is now sort of this construct of like, okay, there's you and there's your ego. Yeah. And if you have this is why I always found sense like this completely lacking sense. If you have a big ego, that's bad. If you have a small ego, I guess that's good. So we're ascribing like sort of, we're giving ego this quantity of size, so to speak, and then saying like it's bad because being egoic, it means you're arrogant, like you think highly of yourself. Yeah, like, I mean, this is why psychology is not a science. Yeah, so we're using like sort of these contradicting descriptors to describe something that is completely theoretical in the first place. And if you go look at Freud's original definition, ego is not anything that you can obliterate because it's just your present conscious mind, which is the point I'm getting at. So when he was describing ego as being sort of the I that is in the present, he's just describing just how you operate on a moment-to-moment basis. There's nothing to obliterate.
Mm.
You know, so this idea that you're going to kill ego, it's like you can kill self-limiting beliefs. You can have beliefs about yourself that are limiting, maybe because you believe you're arrogant, you believe falsely that you're more confident than you are. Or maybe you are self-centered and you have, you know, the syndrome of being like the main character of the universe, mm-hmm. and you don't realize how the universe thinks shit about you. You know, that is a real thing. But can you kill your ego where like, okay, now I'm gone. I don't know. Like, could you somehow do that where you have a conscious mind? No. Because yeah. You still have to shit and sleep and eat and function and wake up and be alive. The only way that your ego would be dead is if you were literally dead. You know, the ego killing, when people describe this experience, oh, I had my ego killed. And like, I really ask them again, like, okay, like you took a bunch of ayahuasca, you did a bunch of fucking drugs. How'd your ego die? And it's always the same shit. They have a bad trip and they realize during this trip, when they're communing with dark spirits or the childhood or trauma, or they're in some extra dimensional universe, whatever the fuck it is. You know, that's a whole different subject we go into. So they're having a trip and they realize, you know what? I've had a lot of moments in my life where I've been a piece of shit, and I have a lot of things that I've thought about myself that really kept me from being happy. And I'm admitting now, as I'm tripping balls, that I actually am really unhappy with this and this and this and this, and it's because of what I believe. And I'd like to change that. And also, like, my mind's literally fucking melting down right now from the DMT. And they come out of the trip and it's like, oh, fuck. Like, I actually, to use a metaphor, they, for the first time in their life, looked in a mirror, saw who they really are objectively, and they didn't like it at all. And now they're going to make what are hopefully positive changes in how they act, think, behave. That's good. That's great. Is their ego dead, though? No, your ego is still functioning. You're still alive.
Yeah.
It just changed what it thought about itself.
Mm.
So seeking ego death, it's for a lot of the conversation around that, it's hippity-dippity bullshit.
Yes.
But that's what I deem it. And I've been in these communities. At one time, I went through like a groovy phase in my life when I was much younger, mainly to try to hook up with groovy girls. And I was around these kinds of people. And when you get into these subcultures, they are completely detached from reality in most cases, especially the guys. And a lot of them are kind of predatory, actually. I mean, I was there to get laid too, so who the fuck am I to say? But it's a certain kind of guy where you really want to like be in that and become like that sort of girl personality. Like, I have no ego, which means I've done a fuckload of drugs, and you know, I'm feeling things and just having this experience of life, and I'm basically kind of purposeless, and I'm treating existence as a sort of, yeah, I don't even know what you'd want to call it, like detached, you know, non-motivated experience, which nothing means anything except like the last book I just read, and everyone's full of shit.
Yeah.
And I don't take those people seriously. I don't take the whole idea of ego killing, I don't really take seriously anymore. Yeah, I would tell anyone now, if you are struggling with life and you think doing some drugs and some ceremony are the answer, maybe it is the fucking answer. Maybe it is. And maybe what you're going to find out, like a lot of people find out, is that you are a piece of shit and you fucked up a whole bunch of different ways and you need some chemical assistance to help you realize that, which is fine. That's great. Good for you. Yeah. But thumbs up. I'm not going to tell you no. But you know, but don't pretend that you discovered some mystical realm and you think you know things.
The type of guy that you were describing before, the best term that we've ever heard used to describe it is he slash him trying to get pussy, which is, yes. It's spot on, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I had an experience years ago, and I'll keep the details light since I don't talk about people I know personally, but I was in this group and there's this girl that I was, we were basically like, it was a girl I was dating. Let's call it that. And I remember like we were going to this, we're traveling the mountains, and as I tried to sort of like talk to each individual person, you're like, what do these people believe about life itself? And it was just this hodgepodge medley of new age beliefs of, I just name something they believed in. Egyptian gods and goddesses. So the Celts, Ayurveda, Shintoism, Zen, like anything that was not mainstream Christianity, they would sort of accept at face value. Like, oh wow, yeah, that's, yeah, it's the universe speaking to you. And I remember at some point I was on the trip, I remember distinctly, and I told them, yeah, guys, I feel like I'm getting a vision from like the, I just made shit up. I'm like, I'm getting a vision from like the Ayurvedic like unicorn guides, and like they're telling me we should go north. Oh wow, oh yeah, wow, are you really communicating with him? Yeah, I am. I'm just, this is straight bullshit.
Yeah.
And like I did this multiple times throughout the week. And I'm like, you can really make anything fucking up. And because none of their beliefs are based on anything objective, they just buy into it. Yeah. Kind of like liberals. This doesn't have to be based on fucking anything real. If it feels good and it sounds good, fucking roll with it.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things you touched on earlier is how you said that you don't feel stress or anxiety. Do you think that what you've been able to do is, and like the majority of society is interpreting something as stress and anxiety, and you're interpreting it as, no, this isn't stress or anxiety, I just have a decision that I need to make in my life?
Well, you have to frame stress. It's like all organisms experience what you could deem stress. But the power you give it, like that's a difference maker.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like before this podcast, I went out to my garage and I got on my Airdyne bike and I did a sprint workout for 30 minutes. But that was physically stressful. Like, of course it was. I'm sweating. It's over 90 degrees, 90% humidity here. It's hot. You know, my body is under duress. Like mentally, like, okay, I'm going to have to push myself. But in my mental narrative conversation, am I calling it this stressful activity that sucks and shit, this is going to be hard? No, I don't ever call anything that. Is the language that you use gives something power, or you know, or it takes power away. If you speak into existence ordinary experiences as continuously being stressful, then they will be. They will. You know, words are magic that way. Or you could change the way that you can change your internal dialogue. You can change the stories you tell about you. You can change the stories you tell yourself, and you can reframe, you know, the world at large. You know, so like you're describing, like, you know, stress, anxiety, it is to be expected that anything that requires focus, competence, concentration, you taking yourself to a certain limit, yeah, that's going to be a stressful situation because it's taxing. How could it not be? Is being anxious about that experience going to help the experience? No. Yeah, you are psychologically conditioning yourself to experience things in a distinct way every time you think of them and how you define them. So, you know, this operant conditioning. If I tell you, hey, man, let's do this workout. Workout's going to fucking suck. It's going to be painful. And I tell you that 20 times before you do it. How do you think that workout's going to go?
Yeah.
Probably going to suck and be painful. If I tell you, hey, man, let's do this workout. It's going to be really challenging. You're going to love it. Like, you're going to feel fucking amazing at the end. And I tell you that again 20 times before I do the workout, you'll probably look forward to it.
Mm-hmm.
Even during if the experience thereof is, again, difficult, challenging.
Mm.
You know, for most of our lives, we're going to hit points in time where people are going to depend on us. We're going to have to be responsible for others. We are going to be expected to fulfill certain tasks and duties. Is calling those things hard and stressful, anxiety inducing, going to make them easier to execute? No. It's not. It's not. So why would you describe it that way?
Yeah.
I don't know why. You know, this is sort of like a, the military, if you take military training, and I don't idolize military service the way some guys do. A lot of men, it's a compensation for what they feel is their own lack of masculinity. But military structures are a very good example of how men operate on sort of like an optimized, like if you were to optimize masculinity and its qualities, you'd have a military structure, you know, military style of execution, you know, like a militarized system. You know, because militaries are traditionally are men working with other men to accomplish a common task. There's no women in the situation, which is great. That's why they're productive, hopefully. So what makes that productive? Well, men are objective. We have a task at hand. We need to get done. How do we get done? We have to assign duties. We need to have people who are skilled at whatever the duty is. You need to train to be good at something. And you know, what is military training? And you know, for pretty much every military on earth, you go through a certain gauntlet of physical experience that requires you to perform. Regardless of how you are feeling, you just have to perform. And you figure out at the end of the boot camp or the selection process, like, oh shit, I can perform at a high level and be a competent individual. And my emotional state doesn't actually have much interference with my performance. In fact, depending upon how I frame my experience, my emotional state can make me more prepared, more competent, more capable of taking on challenge. And the negative feelings I might have of stress, worry, fear, anxiety, they are mostly irrelevant. It's you psyching yourself out.
Mm-hmm. Performance, regardless of how you feel, you mentioned that that's massive because we've completely forgotten what that actually means as a society.
Yes. 100%. Well, and now we try to modify performance based on feeling, which you end up with a shitty level of performance, if you can even call it that.
Mm.
This is why I love combat sports, where if you put someone in a situation, and this is not to be compared to like special forces training elite, but you know, combat sports they're challenging for most people because you're under duress, someone's trying to actually kind of hurt you, and you have to handle the situation. So, you know, if you're in a situation like, all right, we're gonna spar today, and we're gonna spar for 8 rounds. So you know, 8 rounds, 3 minutes, you know, 1 minute break. So we're going to be going like over a half hour or maybe an hour. We're going to do 10 rounds, 12 rounds. That's 45 minutes. So we're going to be trying to beat each other for 45 minutes. The only way you're going to get through that is one, with a level of basic conditioning. Two, you have to be calm. Now, this is why I recommend combat sports for men is basically mental physical therapy. Like, it teaches you to be calm and get your shit under control.
100%.
Because if you're not, you're going to gas out, or you're going to scare yourself, or you're going to hurt someone else inadvertently.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or you're gonna have a fucking panic attack if it's really that bad, and you're gonna realize, shit, like, I am fucking incompetent. And this is why men love combat sports so much, because whether it's jiu-jitsu or boxing or Muay Thai or kickboxing or whatever it is, it puts you under pressure, and pressure is what makes men. Pressure is what makes character. It's what creates character. And you have to act. You have to account for, you know, these stressors that are, you know, being put on you all at the same time. And you realize you're capable of great things.
Yeah, the competency, I mean, my experience in combat sports is through jiu-jitsu, and I feel like the difference between a blue belt and a white belt, obviously there's a certain level of competency, but it really is that ability to actually calm your mind in situations mm-hmm. where you are on the defensive for a certain period of time. Like, if you're on your back and someone's moving into a more advantageous position on you and you don't really have much leverage to pull, if it's one of your first times on the mat, you're going to exhaust yourself trying to defend yourself
yeah.
rather than take the approach of someone who's been in class for 100 plus times, which is, let me slow the situation down and actually mm-hmm. figure out a way to get out of this, or figure out a way to stall so I can at least build a little bit of leverage back into play here. I think the combat sports is totally something, and just physical activity in general.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you build, there's an objective truth to a lot of martial arts and physical activity. Like, if you get hit in the face, you got hit in the face, and you didn't put your hands up, you didn't move your head quick enough, but like, there's a reason why you got hit in the face. So I think, I mean, that's one of the reasons why I resonate with sports like that. It's like, there's just there's a reality that you have to live in order to get better.
Yes. Yeah. 100%. I mean, that's why they're so powerful. Before we started recording, I was talking about how I've gotten more into training cardio, like endurance, the past 2 years or so. Like I was never a runner. Yeah, I basically started. I decided to become like a runner at 32. You know, it's pretty late. But like, what is running? Like, why do people hate running so much? Because running is 100% mental. Yeah. Like, yeah, there's a physical component to it. If you got bad knees, bad hips, Achilles tendonitis, plantar tendonitis, like you have to have baseline physical qualities in place to be able to, you know, pick up your feet and run. You should probably work on your gait. You know, wear better shoes, you know, learn how to carry your body properly through space. Like there is a physical component, don't get me wrong. But once you got that physical component in place, what determines your running performance? Your mentality.
Totally.
Whether it's running 1 mile, 2 miles, 3 miles, 4 miles, 5 miles, you realize it's literally just a decision-making process.
Yes.
There's the physical component, but past that initial physical component, it becomes a decision-making process. Am I going to run for a half hour or an hour? What's the limiting factor? Is it, oh, my body's going to break down in 45 minutes and just shut up? No, your body is going to keep going if you decide to.
Mm.
So you have to choose. And that fucking kills people, especially if you come from a background where you're used to, you know, especially for guys that just like to lift, like you're used to very short duration, intense activities, 45 seconds versus 30 minutes of making the same decision over and over and over again.
Yeah.
It's a challenge. It's mentally fatiguing. Mm-hmm. That's why most people fucking hate doing it.
Yes. And in some ways, it's almost like an epiphany for a certain type of person too, because you realize, like you said, you start to think to yourself, holy shit, the body actually does follow the mind. And if I consciously decide to keep taking another step, I'll finish. I'm not saying you're going to finish, you know, there's obviously different performance metrics, like you talked about, for how quickly you do it. You're like, hey, if I want to run a marathon, as long as you don't have any pre-existing physical conditions, you can choose to run a marathon. I genuinely believe that, which is fucking insane. But most people, I think, don't like to realize that they have that almost like inner power within them to be able to do that. It scares a lot of people.
Yeah. I mean, like, what is even running an hour? It's just like, you said, it's a decision-making process. You're going to have to choose to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. If you decide like, okay, I'm going to run these, whatever, how many miles, like I've realized with running, like pacing doesn't really matter. You know, unless you're going to be competitive in a different story, but like, you know, for if you're recreational or beginner, just doing it for the, you know, health, mental benefits, what matters is the task of completion. So whether it's a fast mile or a slow mile or a fast marathon or a fast run or a slow run, did you finish it or not? Did it get done? Yes or no? It did. Okay. Awesome. Good. Like you're making progress that way.
Mm.
You know, if you psych yourself out halfway through, you're like, fuck, this is really far. Like, why are you stopping? Because you don't feel like it. Yeah. Mm. I remember having this moment in Thailand where I was having to run up this hill and like my feet were fucked, cramped up, calves cramping, like, I'm getting passed up. This is like, you know, it's 2 years ago. This is like, I don't know how long it took to get up the hill. I'm like, I had this point in time, I'm like, fuck, like, and I'm not running this at this point. Like, I'm just taking steps. I'm like, if I keep moving my feet, I'm eventually going to get the top. Like, it will happen. It's not going to happen fast, but I'll get there. And you know what? Fucking did it. And the next time, same thing. Like, yeah, cramped up again. Oh, shit. Yeah, like, feet are dead. I'm like, well, I'm a little bit faster than before. So long as I just keep moving your fucking feet, you know, you'll get the top. Mm-hmm. And I did. You know, and like you guys said, like you have that breakthrough moment. I'm like, it's just a choice.
Yeah.
There's nothing else but that.
I particularly like the mental games that you can play with yourself when it comes to endurance stuff, because like in a lot of ways, it's like your mind is walking your body through the entire experience, like walking a dog. Like the dog doesn't know how far it's going to go. Like the person makes up far it's going to go, right? So if you can figure out the zone to get into, like there is, I think, like a zone that you can just steady state, just keep going. But
oh yeah,
you have to play like these little mental games with yourself. It's kind of I think of like The Last Dance, the documentary about Michael Jordan, like all the games he would play with himself to perform at the highest level in practice and in games. Like these are kind of similar tactics to just like basically fake yourself out into excelling at something.
Yeah, well, that's something that you realize that competitive people, sporting competition, you're obviously competing against other athletes. Like you want to beat other people, but that mental edge, it is with yourself. It's like, okay, even if I'm winning and I'm beating you, can I beat you a little bit better by setting up an internal game? You know, like within my game, it's going to put me like one over on you that much more.
Yeah.
Yes. It's so, I feel like so much of it comes back to programming. And so last fall, Harrison and I, we both did our first Ironman together. And I would say that out of every 10 people that it would come up in conversation with, 8 out of 10 people would instantly respond and be like, oh, there's no way that I can do that.
Yeah.
It's like the instant negative programming. Mm-hmm. The concept of finishing is already off the table. And it's like, I couldn't run. I remember when I graduated college playing baseball, I couldn't run fucking 3 miles. And then a few years later, I'm doing an Ironman. So it's like, if I really believe if I could do it, anyone can do it. But most mm-hmm. people just instantly decide, oh, yep, I'm not capable of it. And it's like, yes, you are. If you choose that you're going to finish the race and take quitting off the table and do the training, anyone is capable of doing something like that.
Yeah, I call it like the low league coach. This is my play baseball as a kid. Like sports have a lot of wisdom in them, but like this is super cliche. Like any kid that ever played any sport, like it's all about attitude, right?
Yeah.
Like you at some point in time, a coach said that to you. Like you had a bad attitude. It's, you know, this is all about attitude. You become an adult, and I realized that like in my 20s, and like you know, life basically is just all about attitude.
It is.
You know, like, if you have a bad attitude, like you're probably gonna fucking fail. You have a good attitude, you're probably going to succeed, or at least you're more likely to not fail.
Mm.
I can't make it really simpler than that.
Did you have any realizations while you were training more, for 6 months, just like very in tune with like, were you doing 2-a-day trainings for the Muay Thai stuff?
No, I started with 1-a-day for the first 6 months, and then I did 2-a-day.
Wow.
I had a lot of physical stuff that I had to like overcome, which it was a grind, but like it was worth it.
Yeah,
I had patellar tendonitis, Achilles tendonitis. Like my feet were dead. I had no bounce.
Mm.
At all. Like I remember, like being able to jump rope like took months and months and months and months and months and months. Being able to run, same thing. Like I had a lot of injuries. I had some injuries from ballet. Mm. Like I had to sort of like remedy it, you know, finally. And also like I mean, this gets a lot more specific, but all the years of lifting,
yeah,
it's like you know, for that's really all I've done for a decade. Lifting weights makes you stiff. It doesn't make you elastic if that's all that you do. And so my athleticism was just kind of gone. Like I was not bouncy. My ability to rebound, the speed line of my feet was not there. And I had to rebuild all of that. But yeah, so it took about 6 months, but then I got it all back.
Did nutrition play a role in that? Were you eating kind of similarly to how people in Thailand were eating, or did you kind of like
not really?
I
mean, this high protein diet, that's always my answer. Like I just ate a high protein diet. What made me realize like with training is that specificity is real. You will be good at exactly what you train for. No more, no less. Mm-hmm. If that's lifting weights in a gym and leveraging load, that's what you'll be good at. If that's being able to be light on your feet for fucking 10 rounds in a ring, that's what you'll be good at. Those two things really don't carry over that much.
Right.
Mm. So my training, even now, has changed dramatically. I do way more cardio now than I did, you know, 3 or 4 years ago. I do very little lifting. And my focus is constantly just on really, it's like what I just call elasticity. This being about light in my feet, being bouncy, being able to move around easily. I mean, I don't really care what my numbers are in any lifts anymore. It just doesn't matter at all.
Right.
And then also, you know, improving fight IQ, you know, kicking. You know, there's a punch and kicking mechanics. Like, you know, there's certain basic elements you have to have in place. That all started like in Thailand then. Yeah, but those first 6 months, I mean, I remember the first workout of it's like 45 minutes. I was just fucking dying. You know, we're outside. Like, you know, the gym had a covering. There's no air conditioning. I'm in the ring for the first time. Yeah, you know, he's, you know, Mike, the coach, he's holding pads. Yeah, you know, like it just, you know, you know, like for everyone that has never trained combat sports, has never trained boxing, or has ever trained kicks, it is fucking exhausting. Mm. Boxing, like it's a certain level of conditioning that's quite unique. Yeah, like if you actually box a round, like nonstop moving, you're throwing punches, and you've never done it before. Like my heart rate was probably like 190. Mm-hmm. I remember this being lightheaded. I was just, holy fuck! And looking at the clock, I'm like, it's been. I remember distinctly. I looked at the clock. It was like I got there at 12. It said 12:07. It's been two rounds. I'm like, holy shit!
Yeah.
Like, but you gotta keep moving, and then you realize that like one of those lessons, epiphany, right? It's like, okay, so long as I keep breathing and don't pass out, I'm not gonna pass out.
Yes.
And then like that was my starting point, you know, like starting from zero, and you build up from there. Yeah, and then of course you get to the end of it, then it's like, you know, after so many months, after a year, it's like, all right, let's go 2 hours today. Like, cool, man. Like, yeah, 2 hours. Fuck it, I love it. Feels good, you know. Or you'll have those breakthrough moments where like you're not getting tired. You're getting fatigued. Like, you can't get truly tired like you once were. It would take just a stupid amount of training where you can go 2 hours and you can keep going.
Yeah.
And like at that point, like it feels good. It's powerful. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like unless you get that, the mental state, like, yeah, fuck with me. Yeah. Like, I'm a fucking man. And then, you know, it gives you a quiet kind of confidence. Like, okay, there's a certain level of capability I have that most other human beings do not.
Yeah.
That's a good feeling.
Do you think that there was also a level of confidence that came from just flat out being willing to put on a beginner's hat and just try something new in a field that you've never done before?
Yeah, I would say so. Like, it makes you realize, like, why are, you know, for combat sports in particular, like, why are most people not good at them? It's because they quit because it's hard. It's you know, if you're going to take it personally, it's a very discouraging process. You realize that you're weak. And this could be boxing, jiu-jitsu. Again, it doesn't really matter what it is. You realize, one, you're fucking weak. You have no conditioning. You have no endurance. You're really easy to hit. Anyone can fucking tap you out. You're fucking cramping up. You're a total fucking spaz. You look like shit. You move like shit. Your videos look like shit. You are shit. And you're going to be shit for a while. So show up again tomorrow.
Yeah.
For the next year. And maybe if you do this for 5 years, you know, again, this has nothing to do with talent. You realize, like, in combat sports, if you do any combat sport for 5 years, you're probably, like, kind of world-class at it. Because everybody else fucking quit in, like, month two. Because it was fucking hard and discouraging. Because you get beat up a lot. So you don't have to be talented. You just keep doing it. And after, you know, a certain amount of time, you're like, you know, I'm kind of good at this. Not the best, but I'm kind of, like, I'm competent at it. Why? You just kept doing it past 6 months, a year, 2 years. That's a secret right there. You know, like, yeah. I mean, I've seen lots of guys. I've met lots of guys where, like, they're not necessarily athletically gifted, but they've been doing it for whatever, 7 years. You know, like, they started around 20, they're in their late 20s, and, like, pretty fucking good.
Mm-hmm.
Why? They just kept showing up.
Mm.
They didn't care how badly they performed on any given day. They kept showing up. And once you get to those breakthrough moments where you get a little bit better, a little bit better, a little bit better, you have some confidence. And it becomes very rewarding and you want to keep improving. Because why would you quit at that point? Mm-hmm. If you've done something for 2 years and you're reasonably good at it, you're okay good at it, why are you going to stop completely?
Mm.
What for? What was all the time worth?
Right.
Yeah, like, why would I stop doing cardio now? Like, oh, well, you know, like I had a newborn son, right? I'm like, so I haven't been able to train the past 2 weeks or 3 weeks. Yeah, 3 weeks. I'm like, well, man, it's just like, am I going to quit now? I'm like, no. But like, what the fuck did I do all this shit for the last 2 years? You know, like, yeah, plus then it becomes addictive too. Because when you actually do combat sports, like, you fucking love it. Like, being able to actually fight with other people, even in a controlled setting, it's fucking fun. There's nothing else like it. Everything else is fucking boring now. You know how boring fucking lifting weights is? Stupidly fucking boring. I go to the gym now. Like, I'm that guy at the gym where, like, I go there, I rest 5 minutes between sets. I will 100% look at my phone. It's because this is just not thrilling anymore. There's something about this that's fucking cool. It's like, I'm going to do the same exercises I did 15 years ago. You know, progressive overload. Like, I know the process. I'm like, this is fine. It's good. It's good for me. Is it exciting? No. Yeah. Is anyone trying to fucking punch me in the face? No. Is anyone trying to fucking take out my legs? No. Am I having to check kicks? No. I'm sitting on this fucking machine in an air conditioned environment. This is fucking easy.
Yeah. You wrote a really interesting article about imposter syndrome, I think back in 2019. Did you deal with any of that when you were getting into the Muay Thai stuff? Or is it just like, you're basically like shit, so you can't really feel like an imposter, I guess?
No, I've said this before when people ask about like personal training. Yeah, I've been a personal trainer. But personal training is the only job I've ever done, technically. Did I feel like an imposter when I was personal training? No, because I knew even on day one that I knew that I knew more than my clients. Because I'd gone through a certification, I had some scant knowledge. So I knew more than them. And also, I was just very objective that everybody starts from zero. What is there to be an imposter about? If you are doing the thing, if you're doing the skill, and you're taking it seriously, and you want to improve, and you are showing up and you're present during that experience, what are you faking exactly? I don't know. Like, you know, then you ask people, and it's because I get asked a question a lot by, like, a lot of young guys, even young women sometimes follow me. So I feel like an imposter. I'm like, are you bullshitting everybody there? Like, you don't want to be there? No, like, you want to be there. Okay. Are you serious about getting better? Yeah. why do you think you're faking it then? Well, I don't think I'm faking it, but I think other people might think I'm faking it. So then what? So your issue is that you think that other people are thinking that you're full of it. So now that's more so just like what I call like quiet narcissism. Mm-hmm. So now you're making an assumption that they're thinking about you and you're thinking about them thinking about you. Like, and that's your problem. That has nothing to do with your actual skill set or lack thereof.
Right.
So that's just what I call like you're psyching yourself out.
Yeah.
If you're there and you're serious and other people can see that, you're fine. Keep showing up.
100%.
Maybe it's more so just a lack of confidence than anything else.
I mean, this is the interesting thing about confidence and self-esteem. Self-esteem is very much like 1990s kind of creation got popular. But this idea that we have to feel good at all times while doing, I don't know, anything. A new experience, taking on a new task, new challenge, new skill, we're going to learn something. It's supposed to feel good. It's supposed to make you feel good about yourself. No, it's fucking not. Yeah, if most of the time, if you are serious about improving at a certain domain of endeavor, it's going to make you feel bad because you're bad at it and it will take time to get good. You know, so expecting it to, you know, pump up your self-esteem, whatever the fuck that means, and, you know, your passion, I guess, of like, oh, I'm going to feel really passionate about it. Hey, most people are not passionate about anything like for a start, but if you have a talent for it or you get good at it for long enough that it becomes rewarding, but now you're passionate. Okay, mm-hmm. Cool. Yeah, in the beginning, you know, as a novice, that just comes down to whether you're serious or you're not. And you can see that in fucking little league sports. You have a group of kids playing fucking pony league baseball. There's those kids that are serious and they show up and they're very determined. Mm. Whether they're good or not doesn't really matter. It's like, okay, this kid's serious. And then you have the kids that don't want to be there. They're not serious.
Yeah.
And that applies to every experience you'll probably have as an adult in any professional environment. You have the people that are working the job, they don't really want the job, but they need the money. And you have the people that do, in fact, care about the job.
Yeah.
Which one are you?
And there's a massive difference in performance between those two people. Massive.
Like, this is like Pareto distribution and power distribution rule most things. Like I was amazed by that when I was like a personal trainer, like at a gym for the first time. Yeah, I was like 20. I think I read like the, what was it called? The Pareto principle. That's a book. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, it's like one of those like, oh, wow. You see it everywhere, right? And I was working at the gym and the performance of the training staff followed that to a T. About 80% of the department income was made by 20% of the trainers. And the rest was just a fucking long tail curve of, you know, the next people in line that made a little less, and then down to the trainers that weren't really selling anything. You see that in gym membership. 80% of gym members never show up. Only 20% do.
Yeah.
And of those 20%, it's like 10% of them are there every day. It's this really small percentage. You see that in professional environments. Like, you know, most of your income, most of your projects, most of your advancement, it's going to come from like your top 10, 20% of people. And then you got fucking everybody else. You know, and if you are in that position of being a manager, or, you know, if you're paying the, you know, your employees, you're responsible for handling your performers, you always have to reward the highest performers.
Mm.
If the highest performers go, if they quit, if they leave, if they say fuck this, you're fucked.
Yeah,
it's all gonna fall apart. Yeah, I saw that happen more than once at the different gyms where the top level trainers doing 30, 40 appointments a week, getting all the clients, they're in the gym all the time, like they're like kind of face of the gym. They quit, they leave, the whole department within 2 months just collapses. Mm. Everyone else, yeah, you know, well, so and so left, damn. I guess, you know, the grass is greener, you know, being independent or, you know, working for a competitor. Fuck this, I quit.
Yeah. Yeah, being in a corporate environment for 6+ years, you totally see how these, like, organizations and individual motivations kind of take form. It's really an interesting social science. We're about an hour in, and we haven't even talked about some of your nutrition principles, which I think I would love to dive into and just hear more about, because you write about it extensively. One of the things you write about specifically is testosterone, which I think kind of plays into a lot of things we've already talked about. But it's this like new age epidemic of a lot of young males having these declines in testosterone and not really knowing what to do about it. But you write about it very consistently. And I'm curious if you have some sort of protocol, mindset shift that people need to get into when it comes to kind of changing the negative setbacks that they've experienced when it comes to testosterone.
Yeah, the testosterone levels, I mean, so that is factual. Like, they have declined globally the last like four decades or so. You know, the reasons why are not clear. Like, it's very hard to pinpoint. Like, the major prime suspects are environmental estrogens. Environmental estrogens, environmental toxins. So, like, you know, plastics, you know, glycophosphate, you know, preservatives maybe in food. You know, petrochemicals, you know, new car smell, cleaning products. Like, you know, what is it, though? It's not any one thing. You know, and for a lot of guys, they have low testosterone. They have low testosterone levels, or like it's stuff I've heard today. They're young. You can improve it through lifestyle enhancement. So that's basically, it's sunlight. Let's just say like a whole foods, high protein diet, exercise, resistance training, possibly supplementation, zinc, boron, increasing vitamin D levels, improving overall like micronutrition. So like things can be done. Yeah, but then beyond that, if you do all that and it's still not going up, then like that's where you have to start looking at like an exogenous supplementation. But I think most young men today, they should be able to get their T levels up, you know, through natural means. Yeah, and you know, probably the things that play the biggest role that I've seen, like definitely diet 100%. Yeah, increasing protein intake, saturated fat intake, healthy carbohydrate intake, yeah, increasing the amount of zinc-rich foods in the diet, oysters, you know, or you know, powdered oysters even, that does make a difference. You know, sleep is a big factor as well. If you get subpar sleep, if you're one of those guys where you're staying up all night, waking up super late, yeah, that can reduce your testosterone levels down by, you know, 10, 15, 20, 25%. It could be quite substantial.
Mm.
You know, it could be more, if you're only sleeping like 5 hours or less, it could be cutting it in half, literally.
Wow.
Yeah, so all that plays a role. You know, but the modern environment is also just obesogenic in general. If you're very mindless about how you live, you're going to end up basically just fat and overweight. That's how it's going to go. You're going to end up being probably 28 with insulin resistance, 20% body fat, skinny fat. You're going to look like shit and feel like shit. And why? You know, how that happened? Well, look at what you ate. Look how you lived.
Mm-hmm. Is there an ideal test range that you think men should be shooting for, like someone in their 20s and 30s?
I would say if you are under the age of 30, it should be, you know, in the general rule of thumb, it should be your total testosterone should be 700 and above.
Mm.
It could be 650. It could be, you know, 590. If it's below 500 total and you are younger than 30, you need to look at your lifestyle hard and make some necessary changes. It shouldn't be that low. You know, that would have been hypogonadal 30 years ago.
Can certain things like, I mean, alcohol is one that probably reduces testosterone pretty substantially. Caffeine intake or like something that might drain your adrenals, would that be another thing that you would look at?
So adrenal burnout is not a medically recognized condition, but what high caffeine intake does tend to do is it does increase cortisol levels. Like it does. You know, that's part of why caffeine works. Like it increases your stress hormone a little bit and it makes you more alert. You know, I mean, cortisol is not a bad hormone. It's just, it can be bad when it's in excess. So if you're hypercaffeinated, where you're one of those guys where it's like, yeah, you wake up, it's like, oh, the pot of coffee, and it's 5 p.m. and you're still drinking coffee 10 hours later, which this is super common in general corporate tech world. You know, just the constant caffeine all day. Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah, if you're consuming 1,000 milligrams of caffeine a day on top of staring at your laptop, on top of being on your phone, on top of sleeping shitty, yeah, your cortisol levels probably going to be elevated, and it would not surprise me if your testosterone levels are low, because there's no way in God's earth that's not affecting your fucking sleep.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've seen this with family members even, where I was chewing an uncle of mine out recently, where it was like 10 o'clock at night. He was like drinking coffee. He's like what the fuck are you drinking coffee at 10 for? Well, yeah, I got fucking work to do on the laptop. I'm like, it's fucking 10 p.m. and you're drinking coffee right now, like a fucking Java mug.
Yeah,
like, you gotta do what you gotta do. I'm like, how many of those have you had today? 7, 8, 9. He doesn't even know. I'm like, yeah. And then he's also caught in the cycle, like a lot of people are that work in, you know, regular jobs. where it's like, I'm tired, so I'm drinking coffee, which kind of makes me more, I'm tired, I drink coffee, it makes me stay up longer, which makes me more tired, which makes me need more coffee, and that process repeats itself every fucking day.
Mm-hmm.
And then you add in like a shitty diet on top of that, it's like, all right, I think I know why your testosterone levels are kind of in the shit. You know, it's not because there's anything wrong with you physically, but your lifestyle inputs are fucking you up.
100%.
I love it. Well, look, man, this has been an awesome conversation. For the people that are interested in connecting with you a little bit more, Ajak, what's the best way for them to go about doing things? Is that Twitter? I know you have a newsletter too.
Yeah. So Twitter handle, obviously, I tweet every day. So AJ_Cortez. All my long form content is on the newsletter. So a lot of the subjects that I talked about the past hour and a half and what was hopefully decent level of detail. Substantiation, like I've talked about them on the newsletter at some point or another. Instagram, same handle as Twitter. Instagram's where I post all the fitness content.
Yeah.
So like it's like, you know, all the training tutorials, that's all there. But those are three places to find me. And I'm pretty accessible, obviously, in the DMs on any of the platforms.
Totally. And there are also some awesome talks that you've given on just like masculinity, strength, some of the archetypes that you talked about on YouTube that we both listened to and have gotten a lot of value out of. But
awesome.
So we'll link to those in the show notes, man, but just really appreciate you coming on. It's awesome to meet you.
Oh, thanks for having me, man. It's a great conversation.
And like we said, in August, if we're not in wheelchairs, we should link up and hit a steak or something like that in Houston. I know you're a busy man, but it'd be great to meet you in person.
Yeah, no, let me know. Definitely.
Awesome.
That'd be super cool.
Love it. All right, brother. Well, we appreciate it, man. We'll talk to you soon.
Good talk, guys. Adios.
Thanks, man.